as her chambermaids cleaned her, changed her sheets, and dressed her in fresh clothes. Wulfric had yet to make an appearance, caught up in court. Sabria had forbidden her servants from revealing the gender of the child to her husband. She wanted to see his reaction herself. Finally, when the sun had yawned and slipped beneath the horizon, scattering shadows through Sabria's windows, Wulfric filled the doorway.
"My wife," he said, "what tidings have you brought me?"
"A child," she said.
"My son," he said.
She almost laughed at the hopefulness in his tone.
"Your daughter," she corrected.
He took a step closer, peering at the babe in her arms.
"No matter. We will try again. At least we know all the parts are working properly."
His reaction didn't surprise her one whit.
"Of course," she said. "Unless..."
"What shall we name her?" Sabria asked.
"You choose. I will name our son when he arrives."
Without another word, he turned and left. She shook her head in wonderment. The future ruler of the realm was colder than the frozen north itself. Once more, she gazed at her daughter. She was all Gaeric, a fact that she knew should have disappointed her. She should have hated seeing her husband's nose on her daughter's face. His square, dimpled chin, his black hair, his dark eyes. But she didn't. The girl was perfect in every way. Beautiful. Immaculate. One of Roth's angels brought to life.
"What shall we call you?"
Sabria asked the babe, who continued to slumber. But she already knew. She'd known for some time.
"Anis," she said. "You are Anis, and you will be stronger than your mother."
"Hurry," Sabria said, as Zelda scrambled to light the torch. Her husband was due back from court at any moment, and she didn't want to be caught in the act. Though Zelda wasn't taking this nearly as seriously as Sabria was, she'd finally agreed to help her inspect Anis for skin marks. For the last 3 nights, while her daughter had screamed and been inconsolable, the words spoken by the legless, armless man had haunted her.
"Death shall come from a royal womb. A king shall die at the hands of his own kin. The fate-marked shall play the game of kings, and many will suffer before peace comes."
Anis screamed, her arms and legs moving non-stop in her bassinet. Sabria was used to it, though Zelda seemed frazzled by the ruckus. Finally the torch caught and a flame blazed in a ball of heat.
"Give it to me," Sabria demanded, grabbing the torch.
Slowly, methodically, she drew the flame past her daughter's skin, careful not to get too close. For the first time in hours, the babe went quiet, watching the fire dance and writhe. Her skin was pale and clear. Sabria was careful to inspect every nook and cranny, having Zelda hold the baby so she could check her back and buttocks. Sabria sighed when she was finished, and she wasn't sure if it was an exhalation of relief or disappointment. Anis was unmarked. She was not death. She was not the king-killer the old man had spoken of before the Ice Lord silenced him forever.
"I will try again," Sabria said.
Zelda shook her head.
"This is folly. You are chasing a phantom." "Even so, it is my phantom to chase, my sacrifice to make."
As if in response, the babe let out a shrieking wail. It was the first time Sabria had been away from her daughter for even a single moment, and she felt naked. The babe had been sleeping when she left, but still, what if she woke up hungry? What if she choked in her sleep? What if? So this was what it was like to be a mother, always worrying. She wondered if her mother still worried about her. She wondered if her mother was still alive. Sabria's thoughts were chased away when she heard raised voices coming from the king's bedchambers. She'd heard the king was having his best day in a long time, and thus she'd left her daughter to see him. Perhaps by the week's end he'd be in good enough condition to meet his first grandchild.
"You will not dictate the laws of my kingdom to me," a voice roared.
It was familiar, and yet so different than what she was accustomed to. King Garrick's voice was strong, powerful, a far cry from his usual weak rasp.
"Your kingdom,"
another voice answered. Her husband, Prince Wulfric.
"Well, you've built an army of bedsores. I've built an army of warriors. And they are prepared to sweep across the kingdoms, taking what is rightfully ours. An act of war requires a king's decree, and you, my son, are no king. Not yet. I have been the king for a long time,"
Wulfric shot back.
"I have ruled, I have prepared, I am ready. And yet you're not the king,"
the king reminded him.
"I am, and I am recovering quickly. I can feel it in my bones. I'm not sure how or why, but I can feel my old strength returning. Frozen hell isn't ready to receive me yet, and I have more to accomplish before my lifeblood runs out." "Absolutely not," Wulfric said. "You are still too weak. You will remain in this room as I return the north to its former glory."
A mocking laugh.
"Really? Are you going to imprison your king, your own father? Is that your plan, son?"
Sabria reached the doorway and peeked around the corner. The king had swung his legs over the side of the bed and was staring at his son, wearing an amused expression. Though his legs were pale and thin, they looked 100 times better than the last time Sabria had seen him.
"Don't test me, old man," Wulfric growled.
The king stood. His legs wobbled and he grasped the head of the bed for support.
"You can't even walk," Wulfric said. "You can't let your subjects see you like this." "Better like this than on the battlefield," the king said. "I shall wave the banners of peace, not war."
He released his grip and took a step forward, more confidently this time. His legs held his weight.
"No, you will not,"
Wulfric said. He shoved his father back onto the bed.
"How dare you?"
the king shouted, trying to rise once more.
"How dare you tell me what I can and cannot?"
His words were cut off as Wulfric launched himself atop his father, grabbing a pillow and shoving it over his face. Sabria stared in horror as the king's legs and arms danced from side to side, trying to fight back.
"No,"
she thought.
"No!"
She charged into the room and flung herself onto her husband's back, clawing at his skin, trying to pull him off of the king. Surprised, Wulfric looked back, momentarily losing his concentration. The king's mouth escaped from the pillow and sucked in a shallow, wheezing breath. Wulfric slammed a fist into Sabria's face, and she tumbled backwards, seeing stars, tasting blood. Dazed, she shook her head, each passing second feeling like an hour. Time was running out for the king. He hadn't even met his granddaughter. She couldn't live with that. She fought to her feet, wobbling slightly. Her eyes roved the room, searching for a weapon. She located a clay pot used to collect the king's waste. She grabbed it, holding it high over her head, prepared to bring it down with enough force to knock the father of her child senseless. Somehow, by some innate sense, Wulfric was ready for it. He turned at the last second, slamming his elbow into her jaw. The chamber pot went flying, arcing well over the bed, spilling its filthy contents across the blankets. Sabria saw more stars, blazing streaks of light falling from the heavens. And then she saw nothing. Wulfric Garrick was declared king after his father was found dead of natural causes. Sabria's husband had threatened to kill their daughter if she breathed a word of what she'd seen Wulfric do.
"No one will believe you anyway," he'd said.
She knew he was right. She knew the only way she could protect Anise, beautiful, perfect Anise, was to stay far away from her. Any affection she showed for her own daughter would be meted out tenfold on the poor girl. Sabria was determined to give her daughter a better life, eventually. And so she and Zelda prepared for the future, a future neither of them ever expected to see. And Sabria dutifully went to her husband's bed each night, sacrificing herself in the hopes of bringing forth the child who was destined to kill him, the one who would one day be known as King's Bane. Postlude 5. Sojonius. The Northern Kingdom. Circa 521. Keeping his wife alive was the most selfish thing Sojonius had ever done. He could see it in the pale lines of her gaunt cheeks, in the dark, sunken depressions that were once her vibrant brown eyes, in the thin smudges of her lips. He could see her desire so clearly, it was as if she wore her heart and soul on the outside, like a second skin. Frida wanted to die, was ready to die. She'd been fighting the disease for 3 long years, years in which they should have been starting a family of their own, watching their children grow into fine young lords and ladies. Instead, Jonius was chained to the crown, because of his selfishness.
"I could let her go," he thought,
watching her sleep.
"I could let her slip away into the night, like a warm breath vanishing in the frozen, inky air."
Jonius held up the glass vial of the clear elixir he'd sold his soul for. He shook it, but there wasn't enough left to swish around, only a drop or two. He could smash the bottle, or pour the scant contents into the fire, watching them sizzle and spit. Physically, he could, aye. But as he gripped the vial with white-knuckled fingers that were beginning to ache, he knew it was a lie as brazen as the one he was living.
"I can't lose her,"
he thought. For he knew if his Frida died, the sun would no longer rise in the morn, and the stars would refuse to appear in the even sky. Not for him. The rest of the world might go on living, breathing, suffering. But not him. If his beautiful Frida died, she would take the best part of him with her, a part he could barely recognize these days as it was. So, selfishly, he plucked the cork stopper from the vial and eased his wife's lips open with 2 fingers. She stirred in her sleep but didn't awaken, her deep breaths as ragged as those of an old man who'd seen too many winters. Sojonius emptied the last 2 drops of the elixir onto her tongue and watched as they rolled down her throat. In a few moments her breaths became clearer, deeper still, and he could almost believe she was the woman he'd married a decade earlier, when life was simpler, when love was free. After tucking the warm blanket under her chin, Sojonius secreted the empty bottle into a pocket and slipped through the door and out into the frozen dark. Though he wore the title Sir, he was no knight, but a devil in knight's armour.
He walked along the ramparts of Castle Hill, the proud northern stronghold overlooking Frozen Lake. Though storm clouds were gathering in the west, the eastern sky was clear, and a waxing moon cast a green light across the enormous waters, which, in the dead of the coldest winter the north had known in many years, was currently living up to its namesake. Typically the walls of the castle shined white in the daylight, but at night, even covered with a fresh layer of snowfall, they appeared dark to Sojonius, like grey stones dipped in tar. The knight knew he was projecting his own tumultuous thoughts onto the castle, but he couldn't help himself. He was taking the long way to his destination on purpose, delaying whatever horrors this night was sure to bring. Along the way he passed several royal guardsmen, who nodded in his direction briefly, before returning their gaze to the area beneath the walls. Sojonius ignored them. The respect they gave him was out of fear, a fear he'd earned.
"What would Frida say if she knew the truth of what I've done? Would she still love me?"
Sojonius stopped abruptly, realizing something. It didn't matter. As long as she was alive, his wife could hate him all she wanted. He'd rather wear her hatred like 1,000 scars than see her lifeless body embalmed in the crypts. One of the guards was staring at him, he noticed, and he forced 1 foot forward, then the other, until he left the walls and entered through an archway into the north tower. Descending the steps was easier, because the earth pulled him downwards, an inevitable force that seemed representative of the whole of his life. He made his way along a curving wall barren of decoration, save for the occasional torch-bearing sconce. The staircase to the lower levels appeared on his right, a shadowy moor that made him shiver each time he saw it. Grabbing a torch from the nearest fixture, he took a step toward the opening.
Sir?
A voice said from behind. He froze.
No.
He didn't need to turn to know who had spoken. Her voice full of the typical curiosity that was reminiscent of any 7-year-old in all of the 4 kingdoms. He loved that voice, and the girl that was attached to it. But he also hated her, too, because she reminded him of everything he would never have, could never be. A family. A father. Innocent. He wanted to pretend not to hear her, but knew she would only follow him down the steps. Princess Anise Garrick didn't like to be told she couldn't do something, and that was because most of the time she could.
Now, what in the name of the 4 kingdoms would a princess be doing wandering the castle in the middle of the night?
Sejonius asked, turning around. He forced amusement into his tone and a twinkle into his eyes. Anise grinned, jutting out her square chin in an expression that eerily reminded the knight of her father. Her round, pale cheeks were smudged with ash in a way that almost seemed purposeful, and her green dress was dirty and wet at the bottom. She wore thick deerskin boots that were too large for her feet by half. She held a stick like a sword in one hand.
"Exploring," she said. "I'm not scared of the dark."
"You should be." "No, I suspect you're not. Still, what would the king think of you being out of your chambers at such a time?"
Though she tried to disguise it, Jonius saw the wings of fear flutter across her expression. She was a brave girl, wrestling with larger boys in the yard and usually emerging victorious, but smart enough to know her father was a man to be feared.
"You won't tell him, will you?"
Jonius pretended to consider it, but then winked.
"Course not. So long as the little mouse princess scurries her way back to bed."
"Can I be an ice bear princess instead? They could call me the Lady of the Hinterlands."
She raised a fisted hand into the air with her declaration.
"Princess Anise, you can be whatever you want to be in this life,"
Sejonius said. Her eyes widened with glee, and a smile lit up her face. She dropped her stick and raised both hands into the air, making her fingers look like claws. She growled, and the knight chuckled.
"Am I scary?" she asked.
"I'm shivering in my armor," he said,
still marveling at the girl's spirit, which remained unbroken despite the tragedy of her infant brother's death 4 years earlier. Anise snorted, and then curtsied grandly, a gesture that was out of place next to her rumpled condition. With another loud roar, she stomped off in the other direction. Jonius hoped she would find her way back to bed before her father really did catch wind of her nightly activities. His own words came back to him, like a whisper echoing down the long corridor.
"You can be whatever you want to be in this life."
He hated having to lie to the young princess, but he refused to take away her childlike innocence so early in her life. There was plenty of time for that. In truth, he thought of her niece as if she was his own daughter, always remembering her name days and surprising her with little gifts. In the back of his mind, he knew it was his own attempt at redemption. But still, he loved the way he was always able to make the girl smile. And Jonius knew she needed a role model in her life, considering her mother, Queen Sabria Lorraine Garrick, barely looked at her, and her father, the dread King of the North, cared more for instilling terror in the hearts of his subjects than pandering to the interests of his eldest child. He shook his head, clearing his thoughts away. Her unexpected appearance had been a welcome distraction from reality, but he knew he shouldn't tarry any longer. He slipped his hand into his pocket, closing his fingers over the empty vial. And then, torch held high, he descended the steps to the lower level. The particular elixir Sejonius's wife needed was concocted by a grumpy old man everyone called Darkspell. Though he wasn't a wizard, not using spells or magic of any kind, but natural herbs, roots, and liquids, his elixirs felt like magic sometimes. Darkspell's work, which was very expensive, was paid for by the king himself out of the royal coffers. Sejonius only had sufficient gold to buy a drop or two of the elixir, while the king could provide a fresh vial each fortnight,
enough to sustain Frida on the right side of the knife's edge between life and death. Sejonius was forced to pay the king back in blood. While the knight watched, Darkspell hunched over his stone work table, which was covered with glass containers of various shapes and sizes, wooden tablets scrawled with senseless notations, and small bowls filled with powdered ingredients, red, yellow, blue, green. Concentrating, the man pushed his long grey hair away from his mottled face. His dark eyes trained intently on the transfer, careful not to spill a single drop of the valuable liquid. Using a glass funnel, he filled Jonius's empty glass vial with the clear liquid, sealing it with the cork stopper when he was finished. Even after the wizened old man handed him the tiny bottle, Jonius couldn't take his eyes off the enormous supply of the medicine left over in a much larger green bottle. It would be enough to care for his wife for years to come, maybe for the rest of her life. He blinked as Darkspell said,
"Here, take it."
And for a moment he thought he meant the rest of the supply. But no, it was a small scroll, a roll of tan parchment sealed with a circle of wax printed with the royal seal, a cracked but not broken shield. Instructions from the king. Suddenly Sejonius's blood stopped running through his veins and curdled, like milk left out for too long. Still, he took the scroll, because what choice did he have? Then he left, acutely aware of the strange man's dark stare following him through the door. He didn't crack the seal and unfurl the scroll until he was alone in the shadows of the royal gardens. Spindly, leafless trees shredded the moonlight to ragged slashes of icy light, which he used to read the words on the parchment, which were written in the king's dark cursive.
"Thomas Henry is a Western spy."
Sejonius didn't know who Thomas Henry was. He didn't even know if the words were the truth, or if the king was simply testing him. He didn't care because it didn't matter. It didn't change anything. Truth or lie, the king had found this man guilty of treason, and Jonius had been commanded to carry out the requisite punishment. Death. He considered his options, as he always did, a pointless ritual that wouldn't change his decision. He could pretend he'd never received the scroll, had never heard of the name Thomas Henry.
Aye, I can blame it on Darkspell.
The wrinkled potion master was old, after all, so he could have forgotten to give him the king's instructions. But even if the king believed Jonius, it would only delay the task at hand. Or Jonius could arrest poor Thomas on suspicion of treason and force the king to hold a public trial.
"At least that will give the man a chance, and then I won't have to carry out the execution."
It would anger the dread king, aye, but not so much as to impact their arrangement. He knew this was the coward's option. Thomas Henry would still die, and Sejonius's soul would still be soaked in blood. There was nothing for it. Sejonius would do what he always did, for the sake of his wife's life. Obey. It wasn't difficult to find Thomas Henry's residence. The man was a drunkard with a big mouth, apparently. Every tavern owner under the shadow of Castle Hill knew the man's name, and had a similar opinion of him. He was a wife-beater, a lush, a swindler. But he was no traitor to the North. A test, then. A test of Sejonius's willingness to obey the king's every order without question. He was a mindless pawn to the dread king.
"Frozen hell," Sejonius thought, standing in the snow outside Thomas Henry's door. "How did I get to this place? How did I become this person?"
His thoughts strayed to another day, to another time, when he was as different as a snow cloud from a blue sky. He'd left home, a small town between Darren and Wahlberg, 3 days past, seeking adventure. He was young, full of energy and hope. He believed in the future, a future that would always be better than the past, if he had anything to say about it. He dreamed of being a knight, as he had since he was naught but a lad pretending with a wooden sword and shield, parrying the attacks of his childhood friends, who preferred to play the role of invading barbarians from the east. He always made them submit, one by one. Everyone knew young Jonius was destined for greatness.
Jonius was daydreaming about the future when he chanced upon the stalled wagon while riding along an autumn road scattered with fallen leaves. The wagon had broken a wheel, but it had not been a stroke of bad luck. No, a trap had been set by vagabonds. They'd dug a long trench across the road and covered it with leaves. Then they'd waited, like spiders in a web. They'd already slain the driver, a travelling merchant with spiky white whiskers, and eyes so grey they seemed to reflect the stormy sky above. Jonius would later learn that the man, Chester Chaffney, had died defending his family from the thieves. Jonius, having not been spotted, wisely angled his mare into the woods, roping her around a tree. Then he crept through the forest, placing each foot carefully, so as not to crunch the brittle leaves under his trod and alert the enemy to his approach. His sword, an old but well-made antique given to him by his father on his 18th name day, was already out of its scabbard and at the ready. A woman was screaming, shattering the silence, mourning the death of her husband, the old merchant.
"Shut your pie-hole,"
one of the thieves growled,
"or you'll be next."
The woman quieted somewhat, but continued to whimper. Through the trees, Jonius could just make out her long white hair hanging like a frozen waterfall. She was on her knees at her husband's side. There were three thieves, one with a bow, one with a dagger, and one with a longsword, which was tucked under the woman's chin, though she barely seemed to notice, her attention firmly fixed on her husband. The back end of an arrow protruded from his chest. Nearby, a young girl struggled against the hold of one of the thieves, the one with the dagger.
"Quit fighting me, or I'll slit your pretty throat,"
the man said. She didn't quit. Her hair contained many of the same colours as the fallen leaves, with shades of red, orange, and brown, like the careful brush-strokes of a painter. Her hair flew around her face as she struggled, breaking free of the man's grip as she charged toward her mother's captor. She was too slow. The man with the dagger grabbed her from behind, slinging her to the ground.
"We got a live one,"
he said, pressing his weight on top of her.
"This mare's got spirit."
He sounded strangely excited by the prospect. Jonius knew this was his chance while they were distracted. He slipped through the trees silently, like a man made of wind. Though he'd never killed anyone before, only playing at sword fighting with his friends, he didn't hesitate, not when the lives of women were involved. The first thief died without uttering a cry, run through from behind. It wasn't the most honourable way of killing, Jonius knew, but what honour was there in thieving a helpless merchant and his womenfolk? Despite Jonius's silent approach, the man atop the girl turned to see what had made his comrade slump to the ground. His eyes widened when he saw Jonius and his bloody sword.
"Who the frozen hell are you?"
"Jonius of Castile, defender of the innocent and keeper of the realm," he said.
Words he'd tried out hundreds of times in his childhood. The man laughed, pushing off of the girl, who grunted. He rose to his feet, tossing his dagger back and forth, occasionally spinning it expertly. Jonius immediately knew he was in trouble. Though his sword had length, this man was clearly experienced with his short blade, and could likely attack from a distance without losing accuracy. Something his father once told him sprang to mind.
"Confidence is your enemy. Thankfully, it is also your enemy's enemy."
This man was overly confident in his ability, something Jonius could use against him.
"I can hit him from here,"
the third man said.
"Get out of the way."
Damn. Jonius hadn't considered the archer.
"If you're a coward, that's what you'd do," he said, staring at the man with the dagger.
"Don't,"
the man said to his friend, who'd already knocked an arrow to his bow. The archer stared down the arrow at Jonius, considering, but then lowered it.
"Fine, have your fun. But when you're dead, the spoils will all be mine."
He laughed heartily. The other man tossed his dagger back and forth, closing in. Jonius refused to be mesmerized by the motion, recognizing it for what it was, a distraction. Instead, he watched the man's feet, waiting for the moment when they moved into a typical knife-throwing stance, the one he'd learned as a boy. Unfortunately, this man was far more skilled than that. He could throw from all different positions, even while moving. Jonius was caught unprepared, and the moment the man's wrist twitched, flicking the knife, he knew he was dead. That was also the moment the girl decided to mount her own attack. She lunged at the man's ankles, grabbing them tight, pulling them together, throwing him off balance. It was enough to disrupt his aim, and his knife whicked past Jonius's ear, slicing off the topmost bit of cartilage. Though he was stunned, he took advantage of the distraction, leaping forward at his opponent, who fought out of the girl's grip, stumbling away. The knife-thrower fled, crashing into the undergrowth with reckless abandon. Spurred by adrenaline, Jonius whirled, charging toward the archer, who was too shocked to react fast enough. Jonius slashed his sword down hard, splitting the bow in two. The archer tried to flee, but Jonius managed to trip him up with a well-struck blow to the back of his legs with the broadside of his blade. The man cried out and fell, striking his head on a rock and going still. Blood drained from a gash in his temple. Jonius spun around when he heard a sound, gripping his sword in front of him. "Oh," he said, quickly lowering the blade. It was the girl, who now had the dagger in her hands. The one that had nearly taken off Jonius's head, if not for her.
"Go," she said. "I don't want to kill you."
He was so shocked by her declaration that he backed away a step.
"My lady, I mean you no harm. I was only trying to help."
Her eyes were like trembling raindrops, her cheeks flushed from the fight.
"I don't believe you," she said.
Jonius wasn't sure what to say to that, so he found himself repeating his practiced introduction.
"I'm Jonius of Castile, protector of the innocent and keeper of the realm," she finished for him. "You don't look like a knight, and yet you recite the knight's mantra like a child reading from a book."
He was stunned. This wasn't the reaction he'd expected after saving a damsel in distress. Then again, if not for her quick actions, he'd be dead. If anything, they'd saved each other. The sound of muffled sobs drew his attention back to where the older woman was collapsed atop her husband.
"Mother," the girl said, "we have to go. We cannot linger here. It is not safe. Help me with the wagon."
The woman didn't seem to hear her daughter, such was the depth of her grief.
"I can help," Jonius said. "What do you want in return?" the girl asked. "Because I'm not for sale."
Jonius frowned.
"I would never. There's no honour in such business. I only want to help. Your thanks is all I ask in return."
The girl stared at him with narrowed eyes for a moment, before finally releasing a sigh that seemed to contain a wintry gale.
"Thank you," she said. "We would appreciate your help in repairing our wagon and burying my father." "I'm Jonius," he said for the third time. "Are you now? Well, Jonius, I'm Frida Chofney. My mother is Nora. My father was Chester. He was a good man who deserved a better end." "I'm sorry. Please, mourn with your mother while I get to work."
She shook her head.
"The time for mourning is after we're safe and on the road again. Else we'll all be dead."
The memory faded, and Sir Jonius realized he was still standing in front of the door to Thomas Henry's house. He glanced around him, but luckily no one was there. Echoes from the memory continued to flit around him like phantom doves. After burying her father, he'd worked tirelessly with Frida to repair their wagon wheel and haul the cart from the rut. He offered his protection for the rest of their journey, which she'd grudgingly accepted, and they'd ridden until nightfall and then made camp. The entire day, Frida's eyes had remained dry. It wasn't until Jonius awoke in the middle of the night that he heard her cries for her father. That was the moment he knew he'd fallen in love with her. A love that would grow over time into something magnificent, almost otherworldly. Frida had told the tale of Jonius's daring rescue, not taking any credit herself, though she had saved his life, again and again, until the crown had no choice but to bestow the realm's highest honour, knighthood, on him. It was a dream come true, and yet he soon realized that becoming a knight had never been his true destiny. No. She was his destiny all along. Which was why he was standing here now, on this cold and snowy night, before the door of a stranger. a stranger he now had to kill. He lifted a fisted hand and rapped on the door with his knuckles. Then he drew his sword. When he opened the door, Thomas Henry's eyes were bloodshot, his lips twisted into a snarl. His breath reeked of mead as he shouted, "What is the meaning of this?" Then he saw the sword, as they always did, and he stumbled away, his hands held in front of him. Sejonius stepped inside, slamming the door behind him. A woman, her face battered and bruised, gasped. Wearing a long dressing gown, she backed up until she hit the wall, a lantern swinging wildly in her grip. Thomas tripped on a chair, knocking it over. He dropped to his knees, knitting his fingers together.
"Please," he said. "I won't hit her again. I'll stop drinking. I'll stop whoring. I can change."
Jonas wasn't surprised at the reaction. He'd seen dishonorable men before, men like Thomas Henry. They were full of bravado and courage when on the drink and facing a wife who was more scared of them than facing the Ice Lord himself. But when presented with someone stronger, they cowered like mice, begging and pleading, the lies spewing forth like bitter vitriol from the tongue of a serpent. No, this man was no traitor to the crown. But he was a bad man, and almost certainly deserved death. Sejonius knew he was rationalizing, but he had to sleep at night, and this was the only way he knew how. He backhanded Thomas across the face, spittle and blood flying from his mouth as his head whipped around. He collapsed into the fetal position, whimpering and clutching his face. A tooth lay on the floor nearby, next to a few drops of blood where it had been ripped from his gums. The knight didn't feel bad about it, not one bit. Mrs. Henry dropped to her knees beside her husband, crying, raising her gaze to meet Jonius's.
"Please, he's all I got. I love him. It's the drink that makes him hit me. You should see him when he's sober. He's kind. Sometimes. Sometimes."
Sir Jonius wasn't necessarily moved by her speech. She was clearly a woman in denial, so used to the beatings that she could make excuses for them without a second thought. And yet, something gave him pause, even as he raised his sword, the tip hovering over Thomas's fallen form. Guilt. Not his own, though that was there too, but Thomas Henry's. The crime he was being executed for was not his own. He wasn't guilty of treason, though he was guilty of a lot of other things. He brought his sword down with a thunk. The hilt wavered in the air, springing back and forth. Thomas Henry was half laughing, half crying. The tip of the sword was buried 2 fingers deep into the wooden floor.
"Thank you for your mercy,"
Thomas sobbed.
"Don't thank me,"
Sejonius said.
"Go. Leave Castle Hill forever. You will not take your wife. You will not take your belongings, save for a small satchel with food, water, and clothing. If you disobey or ever return, I will kill you myself. Is this understood?"
"No,"
the woman wailed.
"Please, let me go. We—"
"Yes, I understand,"
Thomas said, pushing his wife away from him.
"Leave me, woman."
The woman's bottom lip quivered, but then she snapped.
"Good riddance, you drunk!"
She threw a boot at him, hitting him in the head. Thomas tried to stand to go after her, but Jonius stood in his way.
"Enough. Go before I change my mind."
Sejonius watched Thomas Henry leave in the black of night, his broad-shouldered form disappearing into the snowfall. Jonius waited a few minutes longer, and then left. He was certain Thomas would honor their agreement. A man like him would sacrifice his own mother to save himself. Jonius bit his own lip as he walked. Here he was thinking about honor when he himself had none.
"What have I done?"
he whispered to himself. Though Thomas Henry's wife had been told to tell the story Jonius had given her, that the knight had entered their home in the middle of the night and slayed her husband in the name of the crown, there was still every possibility that the king would discover the truth. Mrs. Henry might tell someone, or someone might see Thomas leaving Castle Hill. He'd taken a grave risk. And all for what? To save the life of a horrible man? He shook his head, trying to understand his own motivations. That's when he felt it. A throb of warmth in his chest. A rightness he hadn't felt in a long time. Strength. Courage. Honour. He didn't know if it was too late. But Sejonius was ready to be a true knight again. A protector of the innocent. A defender of the realm. Sticking out his chin, he headed back to the castle. He was going to see Darkspell one more time. A candle oozed wax onto the table, its flickering light casting dark, blood-like shadows on the stone walls of Darkspell's potion room. Darkspell, however, was nowhere to be found.
"Could I really be this lucky?"
Jonius thought to himself. The green bottle containing the life-giving elixir he needed for his wife sat in plain view, unprotected. Pressing his lips together, he strode forward and grabbed it, holding it up to the light to ensure it hadn't been emptied. Sure enough, the clear liquid sloshed back and forth, more than three quarters to the top.
Yes, he thought. Yes!
This was his chance to save Frida and break away from the crown all in one night. His mind whirled with a hastily concocted plan. He would hurry home, pack a few things, almost the same way he'd forced Thomas Henry to pack, and then depart under the cover of darkness. After giving Frida a healthy dose of the elixir, he could lash his wife to him and ride his trusty steed south. They would make for Raiders Pass. They could seek asylum in the east in exchange for providing information on the Northern King. He would beg if he had to. Nothing was beneath him. Not anymore. Hurriedly, he wrapped the glass bottle in a thick skin which he tucked under his arm. He spun around, half expecting to find Darkspell hovering in the doorway, pointing a wrinkly finger at him in accusation. The way was clear. He ran. When he emerged from the lower levels, he slowed his stride to a steady walk. He didn't want to draw attention to himself. In reverse, the same guardsmen regarded him with the same forced respect. As before, he ignored them. His heart pounded, and despite the cold, sweat rose from his skin under his armour. He could hardly breathe, and he was forced to open his mouth. He only let out a deep sigh of relief when his cottage came into view, its curtained windows glowing around the edges from the fire he'd left burning. Everything was as he'd left it. Nothing was out of place. For some reason, when he reached the door, he paused before opening it. Something drew his attention downwards. Needles of fear prickled his scalp when he saw the footprints in the snow. There were at least three sets, maybe four, besides the ones that were clearly made by his own boots. And one of the sets was speckled with drops of blood, the crimson stain standing out against the snow's whiteness like sparks in the dark.
"He knows what I've done. The king knows. Oh, Frida, please, don't hurt her."
He drew his sword as quietly as possible. If it came down to it, he'd fight for his wife's life, as he'd done on that first fateful day when their paths had crossed on the road.
"Love amongst thieves,"
Frida had liked to say, when she spoke of the origins of their romance. Slowly, slowly, he eased the door open. The first person he saw was Thomas Henry. The man was tied to a chair, his head lolling forward. One of his eyes was swollen shut, and blood oozed from a wide cut on his bottom lip, dripping from his chin. His shirt had been ripped off of him, hanging from his waist in tatters. Several thin slashes had been carved down his chubby chest, which was now covered in a thin layer of blood.
"Run,"
a weak voice said.
"Run, Jonius. Frida, you're alive."
"Run," a booming voice said.
Jonius's heart sank further into his stomach as he pushed the door open the rest of the way. King Wulfred Garrick sat beside Frida's bed, one hand stroking her hair while the other played the tip of a dagger along the pale skin of her throat. His dark, well-trimmed hair and goatee shined with moisture. Besides a long cape and bronze breastplate, the king wore an amused grin. He was flanked by two burly guardsmen standing at attention.
"Please,"
Frida said, swallowing slowly. She spoke directly to Jonius, still urging him to flee, to save himself. But he knew it was far too late for that, and anyway, he could never leave her, no matter what the risk.
"Your husband will not leave,"
the king said, still stroking her brittle hair.
"He's not the type."
"Please."
This time it was Jonias who spoke, begging for his wife.
"This was my mistake. I should be punished, not her."
"You disobeyed a direct order, broke our agreement, and stole from my potion master."
The king nodded in the direction of the parcel, still held under Jonius's arm.
I just wanted enough to keep her alive,"
Jonius said, stumbling over the lie. The king shook his head and tusked several times.
"I provide enough. I keep her safe, so long as you remain loyal."
"I know. I just..."
He didn't know what to say. Any excuse would be a lie.
"I will make it up to you. I will never be disloyal again. On my honour as a knight."
"You have no honour,"
a voice said in the back of his mind.
"Honour means nothing,"
the king said, as if reading his thoughts.
"Then on my wife's life,"
he said quickly.
"I swear it."
"You already broke that promise once."
"I know, but I never will again."
He dropped to his knees, blinking back tears. He placed the parcel on the floor, knitted his hands together.
"Please, I'll do anything."
"I know," the king said, "which is why I've decided to give you another chance. Your last chance."
Truth be told, Jonius was shocked. He'd never seen the king offer even a shred of mercy to anyone. Then again, having a loyal attack dog bound by the life of his wife was perhaps too tempting, even for a king.
"Thank you. You won't regret it."
"I know," the king said again. "Now, prove your loyalty, and I will leave you and your wife alone."
At first, Jonius wasn't certain what the king meant. But then Thomas Henry groaned and spit a gob of blood on the floor.
"Not in front of my wife,"
he said.
"Please."
"Do it or she dies," the king said. "My patience is waning."
"Jonius, no,"
Frida said, ignoring her, refusing to even look at her. The knight stood. Somewhere in the background he could hear his wife's pleas, begging him not to do this. But he had already gone to that other place, a place where reality vanished into nightmare, and each time he awoke he was a new man. He raised his sword, gritting his teeth.
"For her, for her, for her, for her, anything for her."
And then he slashed. Postlude 6. Gwendolyn Storm. The Eastern Kingdom, circa 448. Gwendolyn's father, Baroness Storm, would not approve of the human boy. This she knew. She even knew exactly what he would say.
"Gwenny, there are so few of us left, pure Orient. We have a duty to uphold. A duty to our people. A duty to the great Orion who watches over our forests and all those who inhabit them. This boy is not right for you. It's better to keep your distance."
Their secret relationship had been going on for several months, and she longed for the precious days, like today, when her father was away from the forest on the king's business, and she could meet Alistair Freestep deep in Ironwood. Because she knew what her father would say, she was glad he didn't know about Alistair. She was even gladder he didn't know what she was doing with him at this particular moment in time, because she was most certainly not keeping her distance. They were lying on a bed of moss, lit by slivers of sunlight sliding through the thick canopy of ironwood. All around them, the iron-sheathed trees stood sentinel, silent witnesses to their passion. Alice's hips pressed against hers, his lips painting the soft skin at the base of her neck, roving upwards, finding her mouth. She hungered for him, and her lips parted, allowing his tongue to slip inside, dancing with hers. One of her hands massaged the back of his head, ruffling his thick, dark hair, while the other entwined with his fingers, his thumb tracing circles on her skin. His other hand sought entrance to her shirt, a thought that made her giddy with excitement. At 18 years old, she'd kissed other boys, all Orion, of course, but none of them like this. She prayed his fingers would find her skin. And then they did, his fingers like trembling flames, scorching her firm abdomen, brushing the outline of her ribs with his knuckles, exploring higher. She arched her back, allowing him to once more kiss her neck, sending a summer storm of lightning through her body. Alistair pulled back suddenly, and it was like her very breath had been sucked from her lungs.
"Gwendolyn," he said,
and she loved the way he refused to call her by her nickname, Gwen, like everyone else.
"I have to stop, or I might not be able to later."
He breathed heavily, his mouth open, his eyes shimmering grey pools. Though he'd removed his hand from under her shirt, he continued to grasp her other hand, as if letting go would be more than he could bear. Gwendolyn said,
"Then don't stop."
She retracted her hand from behind his head and caressed his jawline, relishing the thin, even stubble that resembled a dark shadow on his cheeks.
"Don't tempt me," Alistair said.
"Why not?" Gwendolyn released his hand and tugged at the base of her shirt, revealing a long, pale sliver of skin.
"Orion, save me,"
Alistair breathed, biting his bottom lip.
"Your father will murder me."
"Wouldn't it be worth it?" Gwendolyn said, running her tongue over her lips. She couldn't believe her own boldness, but this boy made her feel crazy, out of control. It was a much-needed break from the rigidity of the other Orions, and she wasn't going to waste one moment. She craned her neck and kissed the side of his mouth. He tried to protest, but the moment his lips parted, she devoured him. His satisfied groan sent a burst of adrenaline through Gwen's veins. With an agile twist of her hips, she rolled him over and pressed down on top of him, her strong hands and arms pinning him to the ground. Finally, he gave in.
"You are perfection,"
Alistair said later, running a thumb over her bottom lip. His other hand stroked her thigh.
"He can do that forever, and it won't be long enough,"
Gwen thought to herself. She looked at the boy who'd stolen her heart, wondering whether the rest of her life could ever live up to this moment. For some reason, the thought made her sad.
"Only when I'm with you," she said. "Slender rays of moonlight, cast by godly hands, formed into a woman, shifting desert sands. Strength forged by iron, a mighty fighting sword, tender as a flower, a supple leather cord. Wisps of smoke, cool raindrops, an eastern wind that never stops, a bow pulled across a violin. A perfect chord. Oh, Gwendolyn."
She gasped on the last word. Though she'd oft listened to the beautiful imagery of his poetry, he'd never before written anything for her.
"Recite it again," she requested.
He did, and this time she soaked in every word. Was this really how he saw her? As a wisp of smoke? Shifting desert sands? He smiled at her reaction, and it made her want to kiss him again to start all over. Then, unexpectedly soon, his smile faded away.
"I can't lose you," he said.
She tried to laugh his comment away, but it sounded forced.
"Lose me," she said. "Orions live well into the hundreds of years, while you, poor human, will be lucky to make it to 70. "You know what I mean," Alistair said. "Your father."
Gwen frowned, hating the return to a subject she constantly tried to avoid.
"I might not be an adult Orion by the standards of my people, but our ancient traditions aren't adhered to nearly as strictly as they once were. There are girls my age who have already bonded to humans from Feria."
She hadn't intended to mention the word bonded. It had just kind of slipped out, naturally, like liquid ore from a spilled forger's cattle drum. And yet, the word seemed to draw them even closer.
"I want to bond to you, Gwendolyn," Alistair said. "More than anything."
Though the very idea took her breath away, she heard the unspoken words at the end of his sentence.
"But you can't. Your father will never accept me as his son."
The pain in his expression was pure torture for Gwen.
"He will. He just needs time. We have to get him used to the proposition."
Alistair shook his head.
"I don't want to cause trouble between you and your father. Plus, your father doesn't like my father, and I'm certain the feeling is mutual."
Levi Freestep was a captain in the Eastern Legion. According to Alistair, his father's platoon was responsible for patrolling the Eastern Seaboard. In the 12 years since he'd been made captain, he'd seen little action. Every attack lately had been from the west, along the shores of the Spear, the long silver river that separated the Eastern Kingdom from the west. Twice now, Gwen had heard her own father complain about Captain Freestep's tactics, and she was forced to bite her tongue.
"None of that matters," Gwendolyn said. "All that matters is I..."
She stopped suddenly, the three words tingling on the tip of her tongue.
"I love you."
Though they'd implied much to each other in their conversations of late, none had so overtly declared their feelings.
"I know,"
Alistair said.
"I love you, too."
Gwen's heart skipped a beat, her entire body trembling.
He'd said it. It didn't matter that she already knew how he felt. The words still sounded beautiful to her ears. "I love you," she said,
unafraid to hold back any more. Unafraid to risk everything for this man. This human.
"That's why I'm so scared of what your father might do if he knows the truth,"
Alistair said.
"I don't care," she said. "I do."
Gwendolyn waited for her father at the edge of Ironwood. One of the beautiful Orcats, a tenacious but playful female named Sasha, had informed her of his impending arrival, having spotted his company riding across the Great Eastern Plains. Gwen had stroked the cat's sleek, metallic skin and offered her a few slices of the roasted waterfowl she'd been eating. Though the Orcat was more than capable of hunting for herself, she had accepted the meat, purring loudly. Now, standing on the outskirts of the Iron Forest, Gwendolyn's heart was lodged in her throat. It was not that she feared her father. She was no weakling. It was that she feared not having his approval. Especially because she planned to move forward with a life with Alistair, regardless of whether her father gave his blessing. Why couldn't she have the man she wanted without risking her father's love?
Baroness Storm rode at the head of the column, his hair as long and silvery as hers, his eyes as purple as the deepest sunset. He saw her, and a smile spread across his face. Spurring his horse onwards, he closed the remaining distance quickly, nimbly springing off his mount before it had fully halted. Moments later he picked her up and spun her around, as if she weighed no more than a short blade.
"My princess," he said, placing her back on her feet. "How kind of you to come and greet me after a long journey." "What tidings do you bring from the south, father?" Gwendolyn asked,
delaying the other words she needed to say to him. The king had sent him to the barren marshes on a scouting mission. There were concerns that the Southron Emperor, Jin Hoza, was planning an invasion, but thus far not a single southerner had been discovered on eastern land.
"Why should a child care about such things?"
her father said, his eyes narrowing. His silver braid hung down the center of his broad chest, and he threw it back behind him with an annoyed flourish. He was garbed in the full body armor of their people, the iron perfectly molded to his muscular body. The ore even covered his neck, protecting all the vital areas, curving along his jawline and curling above his eyes to the center of his brow. Gwen sighed loudly. Her father was a traditionalist, believing that Orians were nothing more than children until they reached the ripe age of 30. But Gwen didn't feel like a child, and whenever she was with Alistair, she certainly felt like a woman grown. She had aspirations to follow in her father's footsteps, becoming a scout for the ironclad monarchy one day. It was a dangerous occupation, but one she was well suited to for many reasons, not the least of which was the hero mark that she bore on her cheek. On the other hand, most humans considered their children to be grown at 16. Though Alistair was a poet at heart, he'd been conscripted into the Eastern Legion the day after he turned 16. However, he'd yet to see battle because most legionnaires were trained for half a decade before marching to the front lines in the west.
Gwen hoped to be there with him when the day finally came.
"Will there be war with the South, too?" she asked.